You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
My name is Philip Alston. I'm one of the directors of the NYU Center for Human Rights and Global Justice. It's a great pleasure to welcome all of you here tonight. We have a security and perhaps also freedom of expression obsession at present. As many of you all know, our center just launched a new blog, which is called Just Security. I hope you get the pun there. It's www.justsecurity.org. I would encourage you to look at that. We had a major panel in Washington, D.C. yesterday, organized by my colleague here, Ryan Goodman, who is really the key person in setting up the blog and co-directed with Steve Vladeck from American University. Tonight, I want to begin by saying thanks to the Open Society Fund, Sandy Colliver in particular, and her colleagues for having been instrumental in helping us to get this panel together. To my colleagues, Vera Opkenhafen over there, who's the director of the Center for Human Rights and Global Justice, to Audrey Watney, who's probably not here because she's still working, as she always does. Thank you. I won't waste any more of your time with me. We plan to ask each of the three panelists to speak for 10 minutes. I plan to be ruthless and authoritarian in the old human rights tradition in order to enable us to have time for a panel discussion and for questions. I hope we can really engage on this. No topics could be more timely than the ones that we are about to explore today. So the speakers, I'll introduce each of them, I think, perhaps in order, in fact, at the time. So the first speaker, then, is Alex Abdo, who is a staff attorney for the ACLU National Security Project. I should say, just in case there was any... Alex, sorry to interrupt your introduction, but in case there's any grave disappointment, we had arranged for Robert Litt, who is the senior legal counsel to the Director of National Intelligence, to be speaking today. I think that was deliberately undermined by Senator Feinstein, who chose to schedule a hearing at exactly the same time just to screw up our meeting, and Sir Robert Litt had to withdraw, unfortunately. But Alex very kindly came in to present what might be a marginally different perspective on the issues. Alex is counsel in the ACLU's lawsuit challenging the activities of the NSA. He's been involved in litigating the Patriot Act, the FISA, the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, and the treatment of detainees in Guantanamo. Suffice it to say that he's a bona fide pain in the neck from the government's perspective. So it's a great pleasure to welcome him here tonight and to hear his views on the current state of the art. Alex.
Thanks so much for having me. It's an honor to be here. I had debated as a fill-in for Bob Litt to give you five things I would have done as Bob Litt in the National Security Agency, but I'll spare you my wish list. So I've been tasked with giving a broad overview of what we've learned since June 5th of 2013, which is when Edward Snowden shocked the world with the disclosures from the NSA's most hidden files. And I'll start very broadly, and then I'll try to cover what I think is a path forward, what the problems are with the disclosures, and what the way is to solve some of the problems. And very simply, we've learned in the last few months that there's virtually no technical limit to the NSA's capabilities to sweep up communications, domestic or international, and there are few meaningful legal restrictions on the NSA's authorities to use those technical capabilities. Today, we know that most of the NSA surveillance authorities take one of two forms. The NSA engages in the dragnet collection of so-called metadata. That is information about our communications. For our phone calls, the NSA now collects, we know, a record every single day of who we call, when we call them, and for how long we spoke, in addition to some other information. We know that until 2011, the NSA did the same for essentially all emails, including all domestic emails, who we emailed, when we emailed, how often we emailed. And we know that the NSA has other bulk collection programs that we don't know about. We suspect that some of them pertain to location information. Senator Wyden, who's a bit of an oracle in this area, has a habit of asking the NSA questions that they deny and at the end of the day turn out to be true. And just today, he once again asked DNI Clapper, does the NSA collect location information in bulk? And the response was, not under this program. we don't know which program it is. So that's the bulk collection that the NSA does of even Americans' information about every one of our communications. It happens on an ongoing daily basis. It happens today, and it happens to you. If you picked up a call today or if you made one, the NSA will soon have a record of it if they don't already. The other form of surveillance that the NSA engages in is in the content of our communications. And the rules here are a tad trickier, but they're really a bit beside the point because the rules are at the end of the day quite weak and subject to a number of exceptions that essentially give the NSA carte blanche to listen in on any of Americans' international communications. If you call someone internationally, if you email someone internationally, or if you are someone who resides abroad, every one of your phone calls and emails can be the subject of NSA surveillance. And that's a consequence of the extraordinarily permissive rules that the NSA has, rules that were put in place in 2008. If you remember, in 2005, the New York Times revealed that the NSA was engaging in widespread and warrantless interception of Americans' communications. And Congress responded to those revelations, not as you might expect, by putting in place new measures to protect Americans' communications from warrantless surveillance, but by ratifying the program and in many ways expanding it with the law that was passed in 2008. Today, there are two primary restrictions on the NSA's ability to sweep up Americans' communications. One is that the NSA has to be targeting a foreigner. It turns out to be a very permissive restriction because the NSA will presume you're a foreigner if you reside outside the United States, and they have no information to the contrary about your citizenship. And the second restriction is that they be trying to gather foreign intelligence, which is an extremely capacious term. It doesn't just mean information about terrorism, it means information about the foreign affairs. If you're a human rights researcher, talking to a journalist in Syria about the conditions on the ground, you are communicating foreign intelligence, and your communications with the human rights researcher in Syria are very much fair game for the NSA. And it turns out that the rules are even more permissive than that. The NSA will presume that you are communicating foreign intelligence if you're talking to a foreigner, or if your name, phone number, or email address appears in a contact book of a foreigner. And at the end of the day, these rules amount to essentially carte blanche for the NSA to listen to foreigners' communications even when they're communicating with Americans. And the rules on determining citizenship are so permissive that in the course of that nominally international surveillance, the NSA also sweeps up, we now know, tens of thousands of even purely domestic calls. And when those calls and emails are swept up, the NSA's rules don't require them to purge those emails or calls from their files. They can keep them for up to 5 years, and if they contain information about the foreign affairs or information about crime, or if they're encrypted, if, for example, you're trying to protect the sensitivity of your communications, then the NSA can keep them indefinitely. So those, very broadly speaking, are the programs that we've learned about, and that's where the PRISM program fits in, that's where the upstream collection program fits in, and that's where the Verizon program fits in. Those are the programs that we've learned about. And they're problematic for, I think, a number of reasons. The NSA's and the government's primary defense of its dragnet collection of our metadata, information about our communications, is that metadata is just metadata. It's not the content of our communications. And I think that's a myopic view of privacy in the new world, particularly when the government increasingly relies on the sophisticated technology of big data to analyze our associations, to create enormous graphs of who we communicate with, when and how often, how those relationships change over time, whether we call one person at 2 in the morning or another at 10 in the morning. That information can be extraordinarily sensitive, and particularly when it's aggregated over long periods of time, it can often give a more detailed picture about your communications and your associations than even the content of your calls and the content of your emails. That's in part true because content is deceptive. People can write in code, people can write with hidden meaning, people can write in different languages in ways that may not be easy to decipher for an NSA analyst. But your metadata, the information about whom you're calling, whom you're emailing, is very difficult to obscure from those who want to surveil your communications. At the same time, we've learned that the structural protections, the protections that are supposed to prevent these laws, these extraordinarily permissive laws, from going beyond even the bounds that they set out, have failed. The Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, which is the secret court that meets in Washington, D.C., that's supposed to put a check on the NSA's surveillance practices, has shifted its role in the 35 years since it was created. In 1978, it was really created as a court designed to approve individualized surveillance applications. And it was designed to make very simple factual determinations. Is the government's target a legitimate target of surveillance? Today, that court, we know, at the urging of the government in the years after 9/11, issues opinions of extraordinarily broad legal significance that affect the right to privacy of millions of Americans, interpreting what the Constitution requires and what our laws mean entirely in secret, in a way that thwarts meaningful public oversight, that prevents debate in Congress as to the wisdom and legality of these programs, and also prevents public judicial review of these programs by courts that might oversee them, including the courts of appeals or the Supreme Court. We also have learned that the FISA court, troubled as it is already by being asked to litigate the meaning of our laws in secret, also has to rely on the representations of the government. And we now know that the government has repeatedly misled the FISA court in secret filings, that for years programs operated in violation of even the very permissive laws that Congress had set out, and that those violations persisted precisely because the proceedings in front of the court were secret and only the government appeared. There was no other advocate before the court to push the case of civil liberties, to argue that the laws had gone too far, to argue that they were unconstitutional as passed. And that has had a dramatic consequence for the work of the court. Congress, for its part, has also been an inadequate check on the NSA surveillance authority. It has also been kept in the dark largely by the NSA secrecy. Even the intelligence committees who are supposed to oversee these activities can't have the type of meaningful debate that might benefit these programs because they're prevented from talking generally with their colleagues outside of the committees unless they meet under extraordinarily difficult circumstances. We know as a practical matter that it doesn't happen, and we know as a practical matter that most of Congress didn't know how the government was interpreting these laws when they voted to reauthorize them repeatedly over the past few years. And finally, the public has been kept out of the debate entirely. Organizations like the Electronic Frontier Foundation and the ACLU and others have pushed for the last 10 years, really, to understand how these surveillance authorities are being used, how the government interprets them, to no avail. The government has, at every turn, argued that releasing even a word of the government's secret interpretations of law would compromise the national security. And so we haven't had a robust public debate. We haven't been presented with a government's affirmative case, and we haven't learned about the widespread abuses that we've now learned about. Those are the problems. I'll very briefly say that there is a path forward. There are a number of, I think, very concrete steps that Congress could take to end unlawful surveillance and put us on a path toward the type of surveillance the NSA should be engaging in. Congress should end bulk collection of our metadata. when it has a reason to spy on an American, it should go to a court and obtain authorization to do so. Congress should also change the way that our international surveillance works. It should build in better protections for Americans, and it should begin to have a conversation about the right to privacy internationally. Privacy is not just a civil right, it's a human right. That conversation has not happened to a significant degree in this country yet. But in a world where every country is pervasively surveilling the citizens of every other country, it's difficult to argue that we have a meaningful right to privacy. That will require, I think, an international approach, and I'm hoping to learn from my fellow members of the panel about what approaches might help in that regard. But it's a conversation that has not happened yet in Congress and very much needs to if the government is to maintain the close relationships it needs with its intelligence allies and also to respect its international commitments to privacy. And finally, Congress needs to set out for greater transparency to allow the public to be engaged, but also greater transparency so that the courts can be engaged, so that we can have meaningful review of these programs. There's a tension between the government's claims that these programs are so obviously lawful and so obviously constitutional, and the efforts to which it has gone to keep any court in public from adjudicating the lawfulness and legality of these programs. If it's so sure, make the case to the court. Allow the courts to decide. And there are a number of proposals from members of Congress that would put us on the right path in some of these areas. There was a bill revealed last night from Senators Wyden, Udall, Paul, and Blumenthal that would go a significant way toward fixing many of the problems in this area. So there are real solutions out there, and there are people thinking very seriously, even in the intelligence committees. And we're hoping to support their efforts, both through our litigation and also through our advocacy. And again, it's an honor to be here, and I look forward to the conversation.
Thanks, Alex. I probably should have reminded everyone at the beginning about their cell phones. Please make sure they're on so the NSA can get easier access to them. Next speaker is Frank LaRue. Frank was born in Guatemala, is currently the UN Special Rapporteur on Freedom of Expression and Opinion. I should know that better. Frank and I were colleagues for a couple of years as special rapporteurs. Frank is quite an extraordinary person. He has worked in the human rights field in Guatemala for over a quarter of a century. He founded one of the major groups in Guatemala. He's been in exile for a long time. I first met him when I was in Guatemala in 2005 as Special Rapporteur on Extrajudicial Executions, when Frank was in a presidential advisory position. Even at that stage, he was taking risks in a great many different directions. The fact that he is still with us was not entirely assured. He has been through a great many death threats. He has been extremely courageous in the Guatemalan context. More importantly, though, for tonight's purposes at least, Frank has done an extraordinary job as Special Rapporteur. He's developed a much deeper understanding of the significance of provisions that at the international level have for a very long time remained fairly vague and general. He's produced a whole series of reports which really have broken new ground. He's about to present a new report to the UN General Assembly on the right to truth, but we're going to discuss tonight his last report, which was to the Human Rights Council, which I understand was submitted 2 days before Edward Snowden presented his report to the rest of us. But Frank's report is right on the topic of tonight's discussion. What can and should governments be doing in order to respect their international human rights obligations in the light of the sort of surveillance programs that Alex has described for us. Frank, welcome very warmly.
Thank you, Philip, and thank you to the Human Rights Center of NYU for this invitation. And I also thank Sandy Colliver and our friends at the Justice Initiative of Open Society for this possibility of being here today. For us rapporteurs, there's nothing worse than to think that every report we do will be listened to, but then put in a drawer and lost in the walls of the Palais des Nations in Geneva or in some building here in New York. It's much more interesting to be able to share these reports with students and civil society in general, who will take them and research them and even take them forward and put them to task. I really must insist that I was not aware of Snowden when I did my report. Some people say I had a leak, but no, that's not true. The fact of the matter is that this was an issue that was brought to me. Most of the issues I have taken were in response to the initiatives of civil society and the desire of civil society to highlight these issues. And it was brought to me by efforts we had done with Electronic Frontier Foundation and with Privacy International, that they were very concerned about the fact that they were trying to systematize principles on privacy and other issues related to surveillance. We had been working with the Justice Initiative on the Tshwane principles on national security and possibilities of surveillance by the state. And everyone was working on the issue, but nothing was being said officially within the UN. And this is what prompted the idea of, let's have a report. I must confess that I was stretching my mandate, because my mandate is not on privacy, it's on freedom of expression. But the logic I presented there, and I strongly believe this, is that although freedom of expression and privacy are two very distinct rights, they must be understood hand in hand. Because if there is no privacy, then you feel intimidated, and there is a chilling effect to exercise your freedom of expression. So freedom of expression can only exist in reality if people have the trust that what they say or they communicate or they write will be used for the destination they have desired and not be read by anyone else or used by anyone else. This, by the way, is an issue related to national security and the role of the states. But we also raise in the report is an issue related to private corporations because they facilitate the states. But also there's monitoring and surveillance being done for commercial interest, which is also a breach of privacy because they're wanting to profile individuals and be able to send advertisements on this. Another NGO from South Africa, APC, a friend of ours there, was telling me that she put her photograph in one of the social networks. I don't know if it was Facebook or which, but she happens to be a heavyset woman, and she says, I'm very happy with myself. I've never had problems with the way I look or how I am. But as soon as she put her photo, she began getting a lot of advertisements of diet pills, yep, and the best diet and the best exercises, all of which she had never requested. So she says, clearly, beyond the fact that we have the states monitoring us, we also have corporations, some of these social networks, selling the information or the photographs to other people who are clearly trying to profile us and say, this may be a convenient diet for this particular person. Now, what is the conclusion of the report? The report really draws attention to issues that, like Alex was saying, we're talking about civil liberties, but also broadly, we're talking about human rights. So there's nothing really dramatic. The dramatic is the reaction of the states, because they get scared. One of the things we say is that the communications of today are massive because of internet, and this scares the states. But the conditions that we should have for privacy should be the same ones we had before. The Human Rights Council, I did a report, two reports on internet and freedom of expression in 2011, one for the Council and one for the General Assembly in terms of access to that. But in the Human Rights Council, they passed a resolution, which is a phrase that we all supported and that I have repeated, coming from them is very important, is all the rights we have offline, we should enjoy online. Nothing really changes. Freedom of expression is the same if we're speaking, if we send a letter, if we make a telephone call, or if we're sending an email. The difference is, of course, that if you use internet, it's much more massive. The difference that the internet brought is, number one, is the speed at which it works, the amount of people you can reach, but the fact that it is an interactive nature of communication. I mentioned that in my report. What scared many states and politicians was that before all means of communication, you had a communicator and had a destination, a specific sector of population. With the internet, you can send out a message to a million people, and they can respond in real time, or they can communicate among themselves, or they can forward the message to another million people each, or they can network, or many things can happen. And it is that potential that you're scared of. So obviously, this brought them to panic and to the idea that this is the type of communication that they wanted to monitor. But the conditions of the rights of the citizens are the same. Many people were trying in the Internet Governance Forum to establish a Bill of Rights of the Internet. And I said, no, we should maintain, Internet has challenges of its own from a technological point of view, and every new technology will have them. But in the same way that the digitalization process brought to telecommunications. But the human rights principles of freedom of expression are there. And we have to apply the principles of freedom of expression that we have always had to these new technologies. And the same way happens with privacy. We should apply the principles of privacy and the right to privacy to these new forms of expression, of technologies for expression. Now, of course, after 9/11, the debate changed. And of course, after Cairo and Tunisia, the power of internet was seen. And even that accelerated the process. But here's where they brought us into a spiral of a false debate. We were talking with Aidan White. Then, for instance, when 9/11 events happened, the press emphasized, rightfully so, that the logic here, and this was seen by the press from Europe, but the logic here was, let's look at the victims and their personal stories and the effect, the dramatic effect for the society. This is a legitimate story. I mean, of course we must look at the victims always, and we must have a priority of the victims. And this is reasonable. But there was no other follow-up of the state but just to look at the pain of the victims. And with the pain of the victims, and the pain that we all shared and suffered, came the justification that then we have to change our ways in terms of security, beyond even what the Constitution allows or what the Constitution permits. And here's where I say that the basic principle of national security, because in my report I don't deny that national security is absolutely a legitimate concern of every state. The state has an obligation to guarantee security. And I don't deny that there is more risks in the world today than before. The events in Boston recently proved that, or the events in Kenya, in Nairobi, this weekend proved that terrorism is real and it can happen in any moment. I'm not trying to say that that's not true, because that would be false. What I'm trying to say is that we must confront terrorism, but within the boundaries of human rights. Martin Scheinman, our friend and past rapporteur on combating terrorism within the framework of human rights, made that very clear in his reports. And I try to apply the same principles to this by saying national security is to protect the individuals. But we not only protect the individuals, we must also protect democratic institutions. And in general, we're protecting our democratic system. So we cannot see protection of individuals separated from the other. We cannot say that we're protecting individuals and violating our democratic system, because that is a contradiction that inevitably will provoke a crisis, because inevitably it will lead us to an authoritarian form of government. We won't feel it now, but we'll feel it down the road, because this will be the legitimacy of the abusive exercise of power, which is what all the constitutions were always designed to stop. Yes, the exercise of power is legitimate, but with checks and balances, and with participation and notice of society. I always say the most important element of a democracy, beyond the fact that you have a constitution, that you have institutions, the most important element of any society is the participation of citizens. But this means that citizens must be informed. But if issues are done or actions are taken behind the backs of citizens, if citizens are not informed, if these are secret elements that are violating their civil liberties and their constitutional rights, then we're beginning to break our own democratic system. This is the danger. So it's not really a foreign danger that we're talking about. It's a danger that we ourselves may begin creating cracks in our own system. And I insist that the safest societies are the most democratic societies, because those are the ones that have the support of their population, of their people. And the most democratic societies are those that defend and uphold human rights and protect human rights. I always say that the protection of human rights is actually the measure of democracy in any society. This is basically what the report has. Then we present, of course, there have to be limitations to that privacy, like limitations to freedom of expression. There can be limitations to that privacy. And how are those limitations in the communication? When there is a clear, important human right to defend. You have in Article 19, there has to be established by law. There has to be a very imperative issue in human right to protect, and it has to be necessary for the protection. And the measure you take has to be proportional. So yes, if you have a group trying to organize some terrorist activity, doesn't mean that then you should monitor everyone from a single religion or everyone from a single nationality. Because here is where we come in terms of the massiveness of the response, which breaks even the principle of proportionality. So what I say in the report is that all these measures should be taken with certain sort of checks and balances within the democratic system, with a due process of law. Exactly like we used to do with the mail and the phone communications. There has to be a court order, as Alex was saying. I mean, you need a judge to look at it and say, yes, there's a crime that was committed or could be committed, and to prevent, yes, a judge will order it. So there is a judicial oversight in this that will guarantee that this is not an abusive decision. And the best countries are those that have a judicial oversight and a parliamentary oversight. The problem is, here in the US you have both, but the problem is when these oversights are beginning to be sort of modified. In the case, I had to correct my report because I had, in the examples I mentioned, that Sweden did not have a judicial oversight. It turns out that Sweden just created a special court. So I did correct my report, and I apologized to Sweden, and I said, yes, now there is a court. But it happens to be similar to what Alex was saying. It is a secret. It is a secret court. It gives blanket authorization they call it the numbers authority, but the intelligence authority. They give blanket authorizations of monitoring. There is no other counterpart to the government that presents himself to this court. So no one really knows how these courts work. So it's not exactly your traditional and typical system of justice. And what I defend as a principle there is what we must never allow is that surveillance be decided by the government of any country, the central government, those that hold power, should never be decided by security agencies who may do it with the best of intentions, but security agencies will always have their own particular mentality and with little checks and balances, and even less by intelligence agencies. Because if we begin allowing them to make the decision by themselves, as we would say per se, to make themselves the decision and monitor themselves the results, then who controls that power? Who makes sure that that power eventually is not used for a political campaign? Because, of course, in the U.S., there's a tradition of an active justice system, of a very important Supreme Court. But if we allow this, if the U.S. does it, which is what is happening in the debate in the U.N., many other countries begin saying, well, then we can do it too. And maybe the justice system there is not as effective, or the Supreme Court is not as independent. So the precedents that we can create are very serious. So here's where, again, repeating myself, we're not denying that there is a risk, not only violence and terrorism. For Latin America, for instance, the risk is organized crime, drug trafficking, and incitement to organized crime, including trafficking of people, trafficking of children, child pornography. All that is organized crime. So there can be many, many forms of risk in that. But again, all those risks have to be addressed within the legal procedures that the state has. And the state has to operate with its own checks and balances, with its own judiciary monitoring and supervision, parliamentary supervision, and be accountable to the people. That doesn't mean that you reveal all the information immediately. Now then, and with this I'll finish, we go into the possibilities of what happens with those that denounce, what happens with Snowden, to make it more specific. Because this deals with my next report on the right to truth, which I would love to do it even here. We're talking here in NYU. But basically, if you know about a crime, you have an obligation to denounce it. And if you're a public official, that becomes a legal obligation to denounce it. Well, the same principle applies for me in terms of human rights. If you know about a human rights violation and you're a public official or related somehow to public and government activities, your obligation is to release that information somehow to prevent that this violation continues with no liability because you're actually defending human rights. Now, this is a very sensitive question, but this is the fundamental issue, I think, that we're talking about. Because, of course, it is not the same as someone is spying for a foreign power to threaten the national security of a country. That is a different matter. But if what you're talking is of an individual who is not spying for anyone else, who is basically to his own public, is denouncing human rights violations, then I think it is a very legitimate. Most crises, legal crises in any country have been solved with leaks, from Watergate to the Pentagon Papers, etc. So that should also be recognized today. But we're allowing ourselves in the debate of today that we're trying to balance national security vis-a-vis the exercise of human rights and fundamental freedoms. And we should never let that debate go on because there can be no balance. We need national security, but we need with full enjoyment of human rights and fundamental freedoms.
Okay, so I hope we're setting the groundwork for a robust debate, because you can see the extent to which we have a somewhat one-sided set of arguments being put here, and I'm hoping that when it comes to question time, there will be pushback. If you guys think you're going to get away with this. So the third speaker is Katitza Rodriguez, educated in Peru, now the International Rights Director for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, one of the leading organizations working on all of these issues. Katitza has worked on a wide range of the sort of issues that we're looking at tonight and has been central in a lot of the international work around these issues. And I think this will lead us at a certain point in the questions, of course, to what's the impact of the international work that you do, that Frank does, on the sort of stuff that Alex is trying to do domestically, or are you in two different planets? But anyway, Katitza, welcome.
Thank you. I work for the Electronic Frontier Foundation. I want to know if you can raise your hand if you don't know what the EFF is. Okay, good.
Leave the room immediately.
1 minute. The EFF is a non-for-profit organization founded in 1990 that was created to fight for digital rights on the internet. We see in the early days that people were going to be using the internet constantly and that our rights was going to be challenged in a daily basis. And since then we have we are a law firm for the public interest, and we have been defending internet users' rights since 1990 and taking some of the major legal challenges in the United States. Internationally, we do more policy and grassroots activism, working with activists from around the world, from Africa to Europe and Latin America to Canada. Everything that is outside the United States, that's my work. And I mainly focused myself on surveillance, on fighting surveillance legislations, and working with locals together to fight surveillance legislation in their own countries and practices. So as part of my work, we have seen many indications of the increasing of state surveillance globally. We've seen, for instance, that some researchers in Canada uncover a broad network of infiltrated computer systems that include and was targeting foreign ministries, the media, NGOs, and that the data that were being captured was sent to China when Gaddafi's surveillance regime was unveiled. It was discovered that dissidents in the United Kingdom, foreign activists, even casual callers, were caught in this expansive web. But it's not only authoritarian regimes that are doing massive surveillance. Let's go to Europe. The European Union adopted in 2006 a very invasive mandatory data retention directive that compelled ISPs and telecom services to collect the metadata, who communicate with whom for how long, for a certain period of time, of all citizens, all innocent individuals, for possible use by law enforcement in the future. And we have heard today the explanation of all the recent revelations that confirm what ACLU and my organization have been fighting since many years ago about the US NSA surveillance program. One of the issues that we care also at the international level in EFF is the right of privacy of foreigners, because as was explained, foreigners have zero rights in the United States, and not even the e-media take into account this. And even my lawyers or lawyer, the legal team, if I brought that topic, they said, no, but I mean, that has never been discussed. It's like a challenge, but they are reacting. Why? Because of this, everyone. Because of the scope and reach of the program, and because most of the companies are based in the US, and the internet users are global. And so then they are affecting and harming US businesses. So we, 1 year ago, we were seeing all these problems, surveillance and the increasing use of surveillance technologies. So 1 year ago, we get together with other leading NGOs like Privacy International, Access Now, Article 19, but also traditional, not only the digital rights NGOs, but we try to reach out to the traditional human rights NGOs and the media NGOs from around the world and come up with a set of principles that try to explain how to apply existing human rights standards in the communication surveillance. We took into account Frank's report, and we invite him to a meeting in Brazil when we have all this sharing of knowledge that inspire us to write the principles. So we come up with this set of 13 principles. You can find it on the web at necessaryandproportionate.org, and they are printed there too. There are 13 principles that explain the problem of legality, proportionality, and the limitations to the right to privacy, and how this should be applied in the digital context. The principles have been endorsed by 270 organizations around the world. Last week, on Friday, we have the opportunity to present it in front of many members of the Human Rights Council at the 24th session on the Human Rights Council at the United Nations. The event was hosted by Germany, Norway, Austria, Hungary, Liechtenstein, and Switzerland. And we have the opportunity to count. It was an event where Frank was speaking. Navi Pillai, the Human Rights Commissioner for Human Rights, was also attending that event. The 13 principles also provide this set of standards that we think can help to restore the rule of law in this world. And why we came up with these principles? Well, when we were working on this, we identified a lot of problems. And I will highlight some of them to explain why we came to here. So we were seeing a lot of companies issuing transparency reports, chain lighting on how often governments demand access to user data. And since then, Google was the first one, and it was a very first step. We have Microsoft now, Twitter, giving these transparency reports, but that was not enough. We see a lot of problems on transparency and secrecy that we were trying to fix with the principles. First, secrecy on cross-industry transparency report. When some industries are now issuing transparency report, we see no transparency report in other industries, in telecom sector, mobile sector. So we have a total silence on transparency. We don't know how often governments are demanding data from our data from them. Then we see that it is fine that we, from with transparency report, we will know how many times a particular state will be knocking the door of one of these internet companies and how many requests they were making. But we don't know, me as a user, that actually my data was requested and even was transferred to another country. Why? Because that's secret. So we put the principles of user notification, because in the traditional world, when we're this citizen seizure, the police go knock at the door, show the warrant, and there were like a notification in the offline world. But since we are in the online world, secret surveillance has become like the norm. And we want to reverse that. And so we have a principle of user notification. And we want to place surveillance under the rule of law, or that's why the rule of law exists. And we also see a lot of secrecy on transparency reports for national security purposes. Of course, recently Yahoo, Google have been champion and trying to disclose even more information under NSA request. And just a few days ago, LinkedIn has also filed a motion with the FISA court arguing the right, their First Amendment right to publish how many users are affected with FISA courts. But there are even more problems with secrecy on surveillance. Secrecy over government cooperation. We don't know the nature of the relationship between the NSA and Google, Telecom, ISP, or Microsoft internet companies. Which government are complicit with the NSA, or which companies or governments are complicit with the NSA or the GHCQ? So, government cooperation. Then we have secrecy over the nature of the technology. And recent leaks reveal the Balrom program, a program that paints a picture of spy agencies working hard on a variety of fronts in order to undermine the ability to communicate securely and leave a lot of key questions and answers. This means that the NSA has unfettered access to a huge amount of people's communications. To create a backdoor, government need a law to build a backdoor on the internet. You have the authority to give the power to do so. But the law does not exist. We were fighting a possible bill in the United States. But this leak revealed that companies are building weaker security capabilities in their technology. In order to receive government requests, they are introducing insecurity in our tech and products from a secret order, from a secret government department. We are creating a whole infrastructure of insecurity built in our technology that can harm everyone. And then we have secrecy over government power. According to the Times, the British equivalent to the NSA had developed this new access opportunity in Google systems. This means that the NSA is actively building capabilities into the infrastructure. The Times also speculates that the US government is hacking into companies' computers, which is the legal basis. That's one of the principles of legality. We don't operate under the rule of law anymore. But it's not only a US thing, that's something that is happening worldwide. We need to restore it, especially these days that we are just using the internet in a daily day. And we are just disclosing all our data not only what we put on the internet, but what we do on the internet. And that internet that we love, that we defend, is becoming an enemy that is knowing everything what we know. So it's really problematic, and it becomes very problematic at the international level, because countries like China will say, well, if the US can spy on foreigners openly, we can do the same, you know? And that's the arguments that they use at UN level sometimes. We need to, the United States see itself as the pioneer of the internet. But what the world now see is that the US is not a steward of the internet. The surveillance programs look like the actions of a country that's simply exploiting a raw power over the internet for very narrow missions, counterterrorism, with little public accountability and even resistance to litigation under the state secret privilege, or regard for its own citizens' civil liberties. And we see not keen that this level of global health of internet, the thing that you are putting insecurity over the infrastructure internet, how it will affect the global internet, how will affect us, how will affect the internet users worldwide. We have seen reaction from other states trying to balkanize the internet, compel companies to put a store servers in their country to protect their privacy of their citizens. But we like a global internet. You know, that's what we defend. One world, one planet, one world. So we are in a difficult moment, and I think that we need to start having a discussion in the United States about the privacy rights of foreigners within the NSA surveillance program. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Katica. Okay, so the first thing is to announce that this session is being recorded. But this time by us, no doubt also by others, but that's another separate question. So if you ask a question, just be aware that your question will be on record and the answer. Let me start off. I want to ask members of the audience, and I'll take questions in clusters and then get the panel to respond, but just, I think, reflection from a deeply pessimistic perspective on my part. The human rights area is generally motivated, or generally succeeds in its campaigning when there is strong civil society mobilization, and when there it seems to be in the interests of at least a significant group of governments to bring about change at the international level. Do we have that in this case? Because it seems in the United States that this is sort of washing over. The New York Times editorial page is deeply agitated by it. The ACLU is also worried about it. But it doesn't seem to be an issue that is really gripping the public imagination. And the same at the international level. Katica brings us news that the Norwegians are agitated. Brazilians, happily, because we spied on Silma, was agitated. But it seems unlikely that there's going to be a strong group of governments pushing to really take up your sort of recommendations, Frank. So where's the mobilization going to come from?
It's a great question, Philip. There's two things that worry me. One is what you're saying. I think people are aware, but people see it as something natural and necessary, because most of the information we're uploading ourselves. So people are assuming, well, yeah, it's rather tragic that they're taking out that information, but people uploaded most of the information that is on that. Not necessarily the metadata, who communicated with whom, but in the social networks, I mean, people will give out even their address and their activities and their hobbies, and to profile individuals is very simple. So I think the debate on what is more important, whether security or privacy, is out there indirectly, and people tend to believe, well, as long as we keep safe and we can oppose any terrorist activity, we must sacrifice something. That's my feeling. This is why you don't have a constituency for a strong civil liberties movement or constitutional rights movement on this. No?
Right.
And the other issue is the question of technology, because the corporations, and Katisa was saying that as well, corporations are coming to the conclusion, because one thing is handing over information to the U.S., but another thing is handing over information in any country they work in. Because if a country is a big market, for instance, and you want to sell your services there, you will probably, the government will put some restrictions in or ask you to hand over information to them. And then you fall into the trap of saying, in order to keep the market, you will hand over that information. So one of the issues in the report was, or even in selling the technology to rogue states or authoritarian states. So we were saying, if there are, for instance, clear standards for selling weapons, and that there is sort of certification that they should not be sold to authoritarian regimes, well, something similar should exist with the software for monitoring. And then when you, and the principles on access to information come in, because when you try to apply for information of which states or which corporation are doing it, then they say it's national security, we can't give you the information.
Okay, Alex?
Can I present a more optimistic outlook? Far be it from the ACLU lawyer to be optimistic, but I actually think there is a constituency that's growing, and I think there is one in part because there is a consensus that runs across party lines that privacy matters. And I want to compare, you know, I had the misfortune of doing some work in the, you know, detainee realm where we were dealing with mistreatment, and I think that movement floundered in the United States in part because there was not a constituency domestically pushing day in, day out for accountability. That the victims, at least in this country, were largely faceless, and they were largely foreign, not marching on the streets to push for accountability day in and day out, which I think contrasts that movement with what happened in Latin America in the 70s and 80s and up until today. There was a movement that lasted a generation. And I think the privacy movement has the capability to be that type of movement. People are starting to recognize the invasiveness of this information. Companies are starting to compete over privacy. Microsoft and Google are going at it, for example, when it comes to whether they scan your email to serve you at. Microsoft's marketing ad right now is "Don't get Scroogled." And I think that speaks to a recognition both that there is a business interest and a broader community of people who care about privacy. The NRA, after all, you know, filed a brief on behalf of the ACLU's lawsuit. So did Representative Jim Sensenbrenner, the author of the Patriot Act, a brief that was actually authored by the Electronic Frontier Foundation. So EFF and Jim Sensenbrenner joined forces to help the ACLU, and that's something is going on when that happens. So I think there is a constituency that's growing, but it's still in its nascent state, in part because people haven't always understood the significance of their online activities. It's generally been opaque, but now we're seeing it. And I don't actually have a fear that the headlines today, because they're not all about privacy, that they won't be tomorrow. There's a lot more information out there. There's more information coming, and the story isn't dying. It'll be back, and it'll be back in force.
Okay, great. Good to see you.
Well, I'm also positive. I see a movement, and I think surveillance is the new copyright, we say, in EFF. It's like the new battle, you know, when ACTA, anyone familiar with ACTA, this trade agreement that was signed by European countries, the United States, and many others, that was going to put draconian proposals that would censor the internet. Many NGOs, including us, have been working for years. We thought, well, it's a long battle, and we will keep fighting and doing our campaigns, and suddenly, without knowing it, someone in Poland started protesting against ACTA. And it became a huge protest, and it's go wildly through Europe. And then we have the same experience with SOPA people in the United States. And it was a huge movement that came from the centralized way. And I see that surveillance is the next copyright in the sense of that there is a movement that is growing, and our campaign, that is a joint campaign with many organizations in the United States, Stop Watching Us, have a lot of signers. I'm not up to date with the latest one, but it's more than 500,000 of 500 signatures. In the US, with the principles, we have been able to reach out to NGOs, not only the traditional digital NGOs, but the human rights NGOs, media NGOs, women's NGOs, and everyone is start signing and getting involved in surveillance, even if they don't work on this issue, just because they are caring. So I see, like, and I see on Twitter that people are still talking about the issue. So I think that it's a movement that is growing. And we have some countries that want to do something, like Germany or probably Brazil, and probably there is opportunities to do it in the Human Rights Council, for instance. The U.S. will be scrutinized at the for their ICCPR revision in October, and that's a good opportunity. Civil society have asked, and Frank, I think, recommend. Probably you can talk a little about the actions in the United Nations.
Well, hang on. Let's get some questions on the table, and then we can come back and see if that will be relevant. Yes, gentlemen.
Perhaps you should introduce yourself. That's all right.
What confidence do you have that there's really a legal solution to this? Because if you posit a national security state that's essentially lawless, and you know, you go into court and you get court relief and they just disregard that as they have just about everything else, why isn't the solution to this more technological, that you develop technology where the state can eavesdrop? I just have a hard time. The history is a complete string of lawlessness, and even brazen lawlessness or lying, I mean, to the extent that Clapper gets in front of a committee and just lies about whether this is happening, and there's no consequence to that. It just seems to me the track record is not particularly promising for kind of a legal solution. We tend to think that there are legal solutions to everything. And it just seems to me this is more maybe a technological solution is in order here. And I wonder if there are any technological solutions that are being considered or pursued either by the EFF or ACLU or other organizations.
Okay. I would remind you that this is a law school and you shouldn't be casting aspersions on the ability of the law to do everything. Let's take a few more questions and then we'll,
Yes, hi, Maria McFarland from Human Rights Watch. I now work on the U.S., but I used to cover our Colombia work. And when I was covering Colombia, I was working on a scandal involving the intelligence service, which engaged in extensive surveillance of human rights defenders, Supreme Court justices, critical journalists, using equipment that the U.S. had set up for them, because they fed a lot of information to the DEA and probably U.S. intelligence services. I was wondering if you have any sense of how much information is going in the opposite direction. In other words, do you have a sense of whether NSA information is going to other countries' intelligence services and whether that might pose a threat as well?
Okay, excellent. Yes, gentlemen, thank you.
Toby Mendel, Center for Law and Democracy based in Canada. I feel I should warn you that as a foreigner, my statements will have an important bearing on foreign policy and national security in the United States, and you'll probably reach your telephone to be monitored for the next few months. Now, I'd like to come back to the question that you raised, and I think that for a tough human rights campaign like this to succeed, it needs broad-based public support. And I think there, I really agree with Frank. I think that we're losing the battle significantly in relation to private companies. And I mean, even though that kind of privacy may seem less important than national security monitoring, I think that psychologically it's having a big impact on us. We basically, we're all on Facebook, 1.1 billion people have signed up to Facebook, and they have clicked on an accept button and thereby given Facebook wide powers to use their private data in ways that they don't know anything about because they haven't read the privacy policy, and in ways which the public are then, you know, our kids especially are getting inured to, and they, I have kids, and they basically feel that It's not that, you know, that they're uploading their data and giving it to everybody for free. They're uploading it for their friends and whatever, but they are giving it to Facebook, and they understand that that's going to be used everywhere. And that change of values around privacy, which is happening, you know, vis-a-vis private sector, it's hard to create the gap that vis-a-vis the public sector, and they basically feel privacy is lost to them. So I think that we need, and things could have been different. This is a model which didn't have to develop in that way. Now that privacy sacrifice is built into the very economic model of these companies. I mean, you know, that's going to be very hard to pull that back, but it could have been different. And under European law, those consent forms shouldn't really be accepted because they don't comply to the standards for data protection in Europe, but Europe's not making a fuss about it because it can't really take on companies like Facebook and Google. But I think that without bringing the public along with us and somehow building back the sense that we do have a space that's private vis-a-vis everyone, not just the government. Without that, I think we're going to have a hard time.
Okay, great.
A
couple of others. Yes.
Hi, I'm Dinah Pokempner of Human Rights Watch. Several of you mentioned the need for there to be a debate on the international dimension of privacy in this country. I have a legal question for you. What would be your best argument that states, for example, states parties to the ICCPR, are obligated not simply to protect the privacy of those under its jurisdiction and control, but those elsewhere, those, you know, Frenchmen sitting in cafes in Paris? I think that's an important thing, whether there is a legal argument or whether we're really only talking about public policy. And I know this is a topic of great debate, but I'm very interested in what you think the best arguments are.
All right, that's great. Let me take two more, and then we'll go back. Yes.
Hi, I'm Deji from Penn. Worked with a number of the groups in the room, so Access Now over there and CPJ. This is in response to your question about why people don't care more. It's something that we're interested in now as well. We're working with the SLU on this, which is how do you show harm in an open society if you're using a freemium business model like Facebook? Most people are willing to give up a little bit, but there have been surprisingly few social science studies done in this area. So it's actually a question we don't really know how we can show that we're being harmed by being watched. But actually, my question, I do have a question, which is about the metadata and encryption specifically. I find it, I don't know how to describe this properly, but if, say, 1% of people using the internet are child pornographers, or 0.01%, and you have an encryption technology like Tor, which by its nature encrypts not just the content but also some of the metadata and makes it possible for a criminal to hide. In terms of the backdoor question, it's a really small percentage of people who are using it for illegal purposes, but I mean, I suppose what would be the appropriate response for a company like Tor, or which is a nonprofit, or for another company creating encryption technologies? Should the government never be able to see what the content is and how it's encrypted, or whether the metadata is encrypted? And how would you deal with that legally?
Okay, all right. Last question. Yeah, gentlemen.
My name is Fred. I'm from Sarah Lawrence College. My question is about motive. It sort of relates to the last question. I find it hard to believe, and I'm not a technical person, but out of the billions of people in the world and billions of data points that are collected, that it's actually possible for surveillance agencies and the biggest computers they have to get useful data out of all that, to actually to be able to, you know, pinpoint suspicious activity when they're just drowning in so much data, apparently. And it reminded me that someone, I don't remember who, testified that, you know, originally that something like 50 plots were stopped by this, and then later walked that position back, I believe, to just one plot might have been stopped by all this. So I guess I'm wondering if there maybe is something a little more sinister involved that might be about the chilling effect of just doing this, the sort of intimidating effect that it could have on the public of collecting all this data, even though it may not actually
lead to very much useful results.
Okay, I mean, I think those who work in the field of big data would tell you that, in fact, there's much greater sophisticated capacity these days to make effective use of the vast and what we previously thought of as unmanageable quantities of data. But so let me ask the panelists, don't try to answer all of the questions, each of you, but pick up on issues that you think come out of them. We start with you, Katisa.
Okay. Regarding the question on the intelligence agency, I'm familiar with the case in the Lachesadas in Colombia. It's an interesting case because the intelligence agency was dismantled for illegal surveillance. The chief of the intelligence the agency is in jail. And it reminds me, it reminds me the case in Peru because I'm Peruvian, and we have the case of Fujimori, which actually he was doing illegal massive surveillance too. He Montesinos, well, but he's in jail, and one of the crimes, because it was evidence that proved the intelligence agency was working for the president, and he's in jail for several crimes, and one of them is illegal surveillance too. That's the case in Latin America. But I know through leaks of WikiLeaks, published some leaks, the diplomatic cables. A couple of years ago. And in those links, there were some emails where the government of Paraguay and Panama was talking on trying to use, you know, the DEE have cooperation in Latin America for to fight drug enforcement agency. And they were, in one of the mails, the government was asking to use it for illegal purposes, and the U.S. government was saying, oh, it's, you know, their private conversation was, I have an article about that published in Al Jazeera, but was saying, oh, no, you know, if we collaborate with this government, we might be violating international due process, etc., because it's for political purposes and it's not for drug. But they also raise concerns that their drug enforcement program could be jeopardized because they will not be able, like the government was threatening the U.S. government on cancel or close the surveillance program. So, and there is an interesting debate. I have it published in Al Jazeera. I don't remember the details, and I want to be precise on that. I don't have it over top of my head. But I did that analysis with Panama, Paraguay, and then I was researching a little about Mexico because I think the reality in Mexico is similar to the reality in, well, not similar, but it's complex, as it was complex in Peru and it was complex in Colombia. So that was part of one of my research. But I think the recent leaks reveal and probably some cooperation with the UK, with the GACQ, about the I don't know exactly the details, but about the cooperation with the US, with the Five Eyes allies, and including the UK one. So that's what I know about, but I don't have more information besides what
it's for you. Okay, thanks. Frank?
Should I answer the others or
no? Not all of them, but just a quick comment on...
On the tech part, I remember there were two questions. EFF is working on Surveillance Self-Defense International, which is a guide that guides activists and users around the world how to protect their privacy against surveillance. We will publish our newest edition after the leaks pretty soon. We also have a plugin that allows you to communicate anonymously, securely, and it's called HTTPS. You can find it on our website, and it's just put the browser by default on HTTPS and allow you to connect to URL in a secure way. So yes, we don't see that legal is only the solution, but also we are realistic that not everyone uses tech, and the regular user will not use PGP to encrypt their messages, which is a secure program that allows you to communicate securely. And so we need all kinds of actions, and I think that we need litigation, and we need litigation probably at international level, if is possible, or regional level, and we need also education and encryption, and we need also activism, grassroots activism, because it's a very difficult battle.
Okay, Frank?
Maybe three quick comments. One on the encryption and the technological side. I put in my report, all these encryption and anonymity are very controversial. And not so much in the US, but many countries around the world, especially Asian nations. For instance, South Korea has something they call the Real Name Registration Act. To open an account, you register with your real name, you put your address and all your, otherwise you don't have an account, an internet account. And for them, anonymity is a danger, a national security risk that can be used for anything, they say, for criminal activity or just for bullying or for harassment, and they're not willing to accept that. Also, their standard of tolerance for speech, for hate speech, and not for hate speech, but for offensive speech, is much less because it has different implications in Oriental culture. So anonymity for them is inconceivable. And for many other countries, I find that encryption as well. They see that as a huge danger. Encryption is something that organized crime will want to use. But I put it in my report as necessary to defend privacy. I believe that anonymity is a way to defend human rights defenders. And yes, it can be misused by the wrong people, no doubt about it. But ultimately, it's better to have it and well used than not to have it. The same way with encryption. Encryption can be misused, but it's more important to have it. But to tell you the truth, I believe that both of them will eventually disappear. But I see the world in general moving into the mode of not allowing it legally and confronting it technically because of security issues in general. As much as I defend them, no one has argued that against that in the report when I presented it in June at the Council, but you can see the mode and the activity of that. The second issue on foreigners, this is something that will back. I mean, first, what is the argument? I mean, the argument is very simple. I was invited by the State Department to present my report internally to them, and I did. I enjoyed it very much, and it was really, I must say, a wonderful conversation. It was really very good, and I had about 25 people from all different departments, from DRL, from human rights to the regional heads to the legal department to all the different sections. And it was a very, very respectful, very high-level conversation. I was very pleased. But especially the people in the legal department kept on saying, but you're wrong because we did amend the law, as you were saying. We did amend the Patriots Act because before we could monitor all incoming communications from abroad. Now we do make a difference between who are nationals and who are foreigners, even if it's from abroad. But I said, I mean, look, if someone sends a message from Mexico and they're called Paco Perez and sends a message to New York, how do you know if Mr. Paco Perez is an American citizen or a Mexican? I mean, there's no way, I mean, to find out. So the principle is there, but it really doesn't exist. And in contrast to that, I have a response. I said the most important element is not whether a state can monitor foreigners or not. No state, I mean, in human rights, we begin with the principle of universality. Everyone has equal rights, no matter what our origin, our nationality, our economic, social, racial, religious, or any other form of origin. We all have the same rights. And that cannot be violated by any state. So this is a position of the U.S., yes. We defend the rights of our citizens, and the Bill of Rights applies only to American citizens, by the way, and not to foreigners. But this is unacceptable in human rights standards. I mean, human rights only exist for all human beings, not for any citizens, not for any particular sector. So I think, and this argument will backfire on the U.S. because it can provoke a reaction the other way. When Dilma Rousseff saw her commit, I'm sure she knew there were money. I mean, I'm sure there's no surprises in these things. But the fact that it was made public, for her, it was a political problem in her own country. It was not a political problem with Washington.
It was a political problem to the for her to the Brazilian people. If it comes out that she was being monitored, she couldn't have it, an official visit. It would make her look weak. Turns out it came out in the, that the Washington knew before the Mexican public who were going to be the future ministers of Peña Nieto. How do you explain something like that? And as foreigners as they may be, but they will say, look, my rights are the same as yours. So I think it's a bad argument, a very bad argument, and I've suggested constantly to my friends in the State Department, don't use it. I know that people feel that the Bill of Rights and the First Amendment are the highest standard. Yes, but don't use the difference of the differentiation approach. Because we can't say the different nationalities as we cannot say the different races. Anyway, there's no differences. Universality should be the issue on human rights.
Okay. I want to have another round of questions we can, but
yeah,
Alex first.
I'll just be very brief. You know, it's a bit of an irony that the same officials who are the ones who warn the American public and American lawmakers about the threat of cybersecurity are the same officials who are systematically undermining our best defense against cyber attack, which is a technology to some degree, encryption. They've systematically undermined the technologies that secure not just communications between everyday people and also criminals, but communications between financial institutions, the type of technology that secures our medical records and other important information. So I think there is a very important role for technology play going forward. I don't think we can rely upon it exclusively, because today's technology will be broken by tomorrow's technology. And it turns out even if you can secure your communications in transit, it's very difficult to secure your computer itself. And it turns out it might be very trivial for the NSA to hack your particular computer. But I think that highlights what technology can accomplish, which is that it can make pervasive surveillance much more difficult. And if we can make pervasive surveillance much more difficult, dragnet surveillance, then the NSA and other organizations, intelligence organizations, will be forced to use a targeted approach, which is the approach that they should be using. And then we can have a separate conversation about the extent to which they should be allowed to use certain tools in targeting their surveillance. But at least we're having the right conversation about targeted surveillance and not dragnet surveillance. So there's a role for technology. I don't think it's a quick fix, unfortunately, because it's, at least in its current state, secure communication technology and anonymizing technology is just not fit for mass public consumption. And I think, just to Toby's point, because I think it's an important one, and Deji touched upon it too, there is there's obviously a relationship between the debate going on about privacy vis-a-vis corporations and privacy vis-a-vis governments. And I think, we should explore those relationships, but I don't think we should lose sight of the fact that it's very different when a government gets access to information. That's nothing new. The government can put you in jail, Google can't. But it does affect our expectation of privacy. It affects the way people talk about our expectation of privacy. And there's a circularity in U.S. law where the way we define privacy, at least if you look at some opinions by some justices, is by asking what society is prepared to accept as reasonable. And that, in part, is defined by what society has imposed as reasonable. And there is a circularity there which I think is not helpful. I think it really is, at the end of the day, a normative question. What society should we want? And as much as it is a descriptive question, I think there's a role for both. But as people become more aware of the threats of corporate aggregation of data, they become more concerned over governmental aggregation of data. And I think they have different solutions. But maybe people are willing to give up a little bit of privacy for a great email program, but they're not willing for that same privacy to be shunted off to the government without any kind of, correlative benefit to them.
Frank, one minute.
Just one quick, very quick corollary to exactly what Alex was saying is that the question was this also, with the role of corporations, is yes, you're giving in your privacy to a corporation, but the other phenomenon that is happening is that corporations are being hired, or we should take back that term, but are being forced by different governments, I'm not talking about the U.S., to do the monitoring for them. So what we're happening is that we're privatizing intelligence. This is a problem in all security matters. I mean, a lot of the security activity is being privatized. And I have consistently said the state cannot delegate its functions to a private entity, cannot hire private entities to do what is the responsibility of the state. If the state wants to practice intelligence, it has to do it within due process of law, for one, but secondly, it has to do it itself. It cannot necessarily order someone else to do it, because then where's the standard? Who will monitor this private company to do it? No? Then.
Okay, controversial set of issues, yeah.
Snowden, at one point, said he had authority to look at the content of metadata. I never saw that clarified. I didn't think he had it. But if he thought he had it, that meant he probably exercised it. Is there clarity about whether anybody at Snowden's level was authorized and whether he did? Because if he did, it's even a worse problem below the big level if more people have this stuff.
Okay. Alex, you have a quick technical answer to that?
I don't think we have seen much clarity in the documents that have been released, but I think the point he was making is the broader one, which is that the protective measures in place are essentially executive protective measures. It's self-policing that's going on, and we're trusting the NSA to put in place measures that limit the access. And it turns out that their public descriptions of that access may not be accurate. It might be they say only 20 people have access to the metadata database, when in fact anyone who is an administrator, like Snowden apparently was, could also have access. It raises questions. I don't think we have any clarity exactly on his comment, but there are certainly questions.
Right, and there's a lot more revelations probably still to come. Yes.
Hi, I'm Fabiola Carrion from Access Now. I'm curious to hear this question both at the national level and the international level. Among the proposals that were brought in yesterday in Congress, one of them was Senator Blumenthal's bill that created a constitutional advocate. I'm curious to hear your thoughts whether that's actually an effective oversight mechanism. And it reminded me internationally a lot about the Office of the Ombudsman, Defensor del Pueblo, in Latin America, whether they have worked hand in hand, perhaps, with the judiciary in other countries to actually effectively protect due process.
Okay, institutional arrangements. Yes, the lady over there.
Yes, Catherine Fitzpatrick. I wonder if the reason why there isn't more traction on this whole issue is that there are no cases, there's no real individual human faces, people that have been followed that you can point to, or people that were arrested illegally. But to me, that's really what's missing in this whole Snowden expedition is that kind of human rights approach. It's more of an anarchist approach. And it's a lot about what machines' capacity might be. It's kind of edge casing about what might happen, things that are dredged that might produce privacy. But there's no justiciable individual cases. And I suspect there really aren't any. And I think that's why we're not seeing it.
Okay. I think that's an important element, the extent to which it remains an abstract threat as far as the great public is concerned until we can actually see a face. Let's have a couple more. Gentlemen.
I had a couple of points that you raised. I wanted to question. One was the issue of limiting aggregate analysis. You made the point. How does one assume that the data is properly collected, which is a big assumption, how do you limit aggregate analysis? And the second one is Frank LaRue's point about privacy of destination. Are there free expression problems in limiting destination to the motive of the sender? So freedom of information, right to receive information. How do you balance the right to receive information against privacy of destination?
Okay, a couple of others, yeah.
I think a couple of comments so far have alluded to a link between human rights and your state-based citizenship, and the fact that human rights can only be guaranteed in the context, or like forcibly guaranteed in the citizenship context. And do any of you feel like when we go on the internet, in some ways we are surrendering those entitlements, that we have a more stateless identity when we go online, that in some ways subjects us to a much weaker set of human rights protections, and those things are implicit in our, you know, our willingness to sign these agreements or to click on these agreements without reading them, but also just in the fact that when you're on the internet, you don't, you're believed to be a certain identity, but you don't carry it with you the way that you do, you know, in a geographic space.
Okay. All right. Yes, gentlemen here.
Yeah, I'm Ken Hurwitz from the Open Society Justice Initiative. I came late, so I may have missed this, but how much do we...
That's a very good excuse for getting here late.
How much do we know about what other countries that are not subject to any kind of comparable public opinion or other control, such as China or Russia, lots of other countries in Eastern Europe? I mean, are they, even if we were to be able to set up some kind of controls, a combination of technological and legal controls here, what stops the technology from advancing in other places where they're not really subject to, at least at this point, to those kinds of political controls? I remember that when Gaddafi was overthrown, there was newspaper reporting about people who had broken into the Secret Service there, and it was mind-boggling to me, at least, that they had the capacity to listen to every telephone conversation in Libya at the time. Of course, it was European and Western technology that was allowing them to do that. But to what extent are we sort of a tempest in a teapot that's actually much more sinister?
Okay, we've only got 5 minutes left. There's going to be a brief reception afterwards, so we can. But I think we have to give the panelists the opportunity to make a final statement. Frank, do you want to go first? I'm being arbitrary here, but trying to vary the order.
Two things on the fact that human rights can only be exercised as a citizen. That's a statement I would not agree on. Human rights are the responsibility of the state, this is true, but they are simultaneously the responsibility of all states and also of the international community, which is why we have international standards. So even if you are in the sea, for instance, out of the jurisdiction of any state, in international waters, you still exercise human rights, you still have rights. It doesn't mean you have to be under the jurisdiction of a particular state or be a citizen of any state. It is true that most human rights are transferred into constitutional rights, and that certainly is the case in the U.S. when you talk about the Bill of Rights, but that doesn't mean that that is the only way to enjoy human rights or that all human rights recognized internationally are registered in the constitution of every country either. That should be the case, but it isn't. So I think we do have to make it very clear that we do have international standards that are applicable anywhere to anyone, including in non-territorial areas of the world like international waters or international space or whatever, as long as we're human beings. I mean, and this is where the UN comes in. I mean, this is why you have international bodies. So that I think is an important distinction to make. In terms of other states developing technology, I think the technology is being developed everywhere. The fact of the matter is that some people have more capability. Some countries have more capability. Certainly the U.S. does, and even before China, I would say India has a lot of more research and technological development. So we should have the pretension that although most of the advancement of internet is in the U.S. and Europe, that does not mean at all that research is not being done around the world. And yes, that is something we have to, something very contentious, which is why I insist that this debate on privacy is not a debate on the U.S. per se. I mean, Snowden brought the scandal to the NSA because of the massiveness of the information he released. But the issue has to be raised with any state, anywhere, and everywhere, whether they have the technology or not, or they're importing it from another country, or a private company is doing them the favor. The fact of the matter is that privacy should prevail.
Okay, Katica?
I did mention the Gaddafi example in my speech, but I was talking about cross-border surveillance. Indeed, that's a problem. We see it not only in Libya, but we or with Gaddafi, but we also see it with these Canadian researchers that identified in 2009 a lot of computers that were documents that were stolen and sent it to IP in China. Or you also see with proposals like in Germany that are using Trojans to spy on others. And while this is via email, that email could be not necessarily be in Germany. And so you still will do surveillance from cross-border surveillance from domestic soil. So the use of Trojans or malwares on surveillance raises a lot of concerns too on this cross-border surveillance debate. And we see we did also with the data retention directive, because if you communicate with a European, then your through email, your IC, the ISP of your friend in Europe will collect and store the metadata of who will be with whom, and probably your data is captured there too. So I see a global problem that is really very problematic. I see a scenario that is very dark, but I think that we should not give up. That's why there is a need, as I mentioned in my talk, to restore human rights in the court at the heart of the surveillance law. And that's why we came up with this set of principles and try to enlighten states around the world, at least to bring back the rule of law. And this is just one space. It's not to solve all the surveillance problem, but at least to solve a piece of the puzzle that we consider quite important. And just to finalize, I want to give the URL of the principles. If there are more NGOs here, we are open for signatures for NGOs and experts. And so just go to the website necessaryandproportionate.org. And you can read, it's in 30 languages now.
Okay, good. Alex?
Sure, so just a couple comments. On your question, Claudia, about the constitutional advocate, I have some reservations about bolstering a process that is too secret to begin with and giving it a legitimacy that I don't think it should have in our system of publicly adjudicating the meaning of our laws. I think when courts decide what the contours of our constitutional protections are, those decisions must be public. And I think the litigation that surrounds that decision-making should be public itself. Mm-hmm. People should be involved. It shouldn't be behind closed doors. And so I have reservations about making that, bolstering this process that is too secret to begin with. And I want to talk about briefly Catherine's question, and maybe she others, Catherine, and the gentleman in the back, because I think those questions are actually relatively similar in my mind. Catherine's question was about whether there are human cases and whether that's the reason why the story hasn't picked up. And I think that's in large part true. If you look at the abuses of the 70s, those surveillance abuses, I think they really captured the public's imagination because there were specific and concrete examples of surveillance gone wrong. You had surveillance of Martin Luther King Jr. You had surveillance of well-known lefty and righty groups and anarchist groups. And that surveillance, I think, really captured the public imagination. I think one of the reasons why we haven't seen those examples could be in part because of the extraordinary secrecy that there still is. But it could also be because of the mode of surveillance that we're now entering. Whereas in the 70s, the new technology was being able to acquire those communications. Now the new technology is being able to acquire those communications en masse, to get not just an extraordinarily detailed view of one person, but an extraordinarily detailed view of millions of people at a time. And that aggregated collection is the new mode of surveillance. And I don't know whether we can put meaningful limits on that data once it's in government hands. The government typically argues that once it has lawfully collected information, that you cannot lawfully restrict its use of that information. That is the general argument it makes. It doesn't always make that argument, but it frequently makes that argument. And so I have concerns about trying to allow them access to aggregated information and then build in protections. I think the surveillance should be targeted at the outset to prevent the need to have to rely upon very difficult to patrol technical or legal limitations on their use of that information.
Great. Let's hope that the next Snowden revelations show widespread surveillance of Republican members of Congress and specific leaders of the Tea Party. Then perhaps we'll get some action. Frank wanted one final just 30 seconds.
Two very quick things that I missed and I wanted to mention. There is a danger in all this debate, which is the fact that, and it happened in this event where we were with Katica in Geneva, the Human Rights Council, on Friday, that several states, I'm not going to mention them, but that are trying to put controls over internet, were using the argument of, yes, since there has been a breach of privacy, and since this is a problem, should we then have an international regulatory body to control internet? And this is very dangerous, because obviously their attempt is not to democratize internet, is to reduce and to control. And more specifically, even if I work for the UN, I can say that their intention is to move the internet governance to the ITU, the International Telecommunications Union, because that is an institution they can move just by simple vote, and who has it, which doesn't make sense. I said, an internet is not a voting question, it's a multi-stakeholder dialogue. But this is the attempt, so there is a danger that even in our good intention of bringing this debate abroad, there's people on the opposite side that are going to say, yes, you're right, there is a problem of privacy because there's too much surveillance, let's have a regulatory body. So we must be very cautious and very careful not falling into that trap.
Good. Thank you very much. I'd like to thank again the Open Society Justice Institute for having facilitated this, and thank Frank and the other panelists for coming on.